Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. HRN is food radio supported by you. Learn more at heritageradionetwork.org.
Today's program is brought to you by Korin, a supplier of Japanese chef knives and restaurant supplies. For more information, visit korin.com.
Hello, welcome to Japanese. I'm your host, Akiko Tema, a food writer and the director of the New York Japanese Culinary Academy, which promotes a deep understanding of Japanese cuisine in America. We are broadcasting live from Brooklyn, New York. This show is all about Japanese food and food culture. We see sushi every day on the supermarket, but what is beyond sushi? We hear dashi ramen izakaya, but what exactly are they? Japanese food is still a mystery for many people, and I try to demystify it in this program with my good guests. My guest today is Todd Bellamy, who is the owner and brewer of Father's Star Sake in Massachusetts. Todd joined us in episode 36 to discuss his previous brewery called Dovetail Sake in 2016. And his success at Dovetail Sake led him to the opening of his new brewery, Father's Star Sake, in 2021. And Todd not only has been producing high-quality, authentic style of sake, but has also witnessed the development of the American sake culture as an insider. Now, we have dozens of notable sake breweries in the U.S., and this is an exciting time to drink locally made, delicious Japanese sake in America. So today, we'll discuss how Todd successfully convinced American beverage lovers to drink Japanese sake in Massachusetts, his new products at Father's Star Sake that would inspire sake lovers and novices, and the fascinating recent changes in American sake production, and much, much more. But before you start, Japanese is available on the Heritage Radio Network website, as well as on iTunes, Stitcher, and Spotify as a podcast. So please go to iTunes, Stitcher, Spotify, whichever you listen to, and subscribe to Japanese. And please write a review. We appreciate your feedback. Now, let's start a conversation with Todd Bellamy. Hello, Todd. Welcome back to the show.
Hey, thanks a lot. I'm sorry it took me so long to get back and do a second episode.
You're a busy man. So, yeah, there's a lot going on. And then it was 2016. So, yeah, we'll talk about what happened and what you're working on. And there's so much to share with you. So for our listeners who have not listened to episodes 36, could you tell us your super unique background and how you eventually got into sake making in New England?
Absolutely. I lived in Japan for a few years. And while living there, I fell in love with fresh, delicious sake and Japanese food. And when I returned to the United States, I just couldn't let it go. So I started trying to encourage my love of sake and Japanese food by making a lot of things at home. Luckily for me at the time, I worked for 8 years in the American craft beer industry and got a lot of great education about brewing and brewing science. So I kept homebrewing sake and taking occasional trips back to Japan to learn sake brewing in some really great breweries. And then the homebrewing just kind of took on a mind of its own. So, we built, you know, bigger batches. And then, it became pretty clear that sake should just be a career, not a hobby.
Right. So, and then you missed out something very, very interesting pieces. So you studied Japanese at college and then
I did.
You worked, under a sword maker to become a sword maker.
Yeah, absolutely. I've done a couple. I've done a lot of varied things. I'm a bit of a tinkerer. I like to make stuff. And so, you know, I also worked for almost 10 years in the restaurant industry, studied Japanese and linguistics at University of Massachusetts at Amherst. And then just really wanted to go to Japan to kind of see where I wanted to apply that knowledge. And so at the time, I studied martial arts and I had an interest in swords. So I convinced a crazy countryside sword maker to take me on as an apprentice for a while. So the first year I lived in Japan, I did indeed work under a sword master and was his apprentice to learn more about sword making.
And then there was the time that first night you stayed at Swordmaker's house, you had a sip of real Japanese sake, and that changed the whole thing.
Absolutely. That's kind of, that's really my aha moment. But we kind of celebrated my arrival. We very informally, sitting on the floor, I think I used a coffee mug to drink the sake out of because we didn't have enough like glasses. And the sake was really amazing. Up till then, I'd only had very, very inexpensive mass-produced sake in college, and I had no idea what real sake tasted like. So I remember distinctly, because I had a big food background, I remember distinctly thinking not only how complex the sake was, but also how it went really well with snacks and food items that we were snacking on at the time. And so I just kind of filed it away in the back of my head thinking maybe they had like a special bottle of sake for my arrival. And it wasn't until a couple of years later that I found out that it was a very inexpensive kind of everyday sake. So it still blew my mind, but it was, it was Otokoyama Junma Ginjo.
That's a pretty good sake, I have to say.
Yeah. At the time, I don't know what's going on now in Japan, but at the time when I lived in Japan, I remember running into a bottle of it, and it was, a big 1.8 liter bottle was under $20 or under $15. it was shockingly cheap to me. So, I was surprised. But I've since learned that most of the sake that comes out of Japan is, equally as delicious and complex and interesting. And so, yeah.
Right. Well, that's the beauty of sake, Japanese sake making, because they say now the number of operating sake breweries could be even under 1,000. And there are really factory-made sake breweries, but the majority that we are talking about, they are all artisanal, family-owned, very traditional. And it's not just a making beverage. It's a whole history and culture and styles and just a whole thing in one bottle. So that's the one thing I think more than many other people in Japan even.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I think it's, we do get some customers who come to the tap room and sort of assume that because sake is Japanese people know a lot about it. But that's not true, right? Even the average person in Japan doesn't really know a lot about brewing sake or that kind of thing. It's, it's around, it's in their life, but they don't know a lot about the making of it. But to your point, I think it's interesting. I think people eventually, especially this day, new consumers, new drinkers, new discoverers to sake are looking for authenticity, right? So they want a brand, but they want it to be really connected to who's making this, where the ingredients come from. And that fact is pretty much an everyday fact in Japanese artisanal breweries in Japan. And so right now, even though sake is not a huge part of the Japanese alcohol market, the only portion of that that's growing is premium sake, right? So even in Japan, consumers are going, hey, we're not drinking sake all the time, but when we do drink it, we're looking for handmade, authentic, artisanal beverages, not, we're going to immediately reach for a mass-produced sake.
And thanks to the internet, all those social media, we have plenty of information and the stories behind each bottle, which I think is why we eat or drink or anything we put into our body, because we know the story and we want to appreciate as much as we can. So sake, it's packed with all those episodes and culture and passion and love and all those things. I think it's easy to love, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. I've actually seen, it's funny you mentioned that, I've actually seen an uptick in small Japanese breweries jumping onto Instagram or YouTube or whatever. I've seen a real big uptick in that in the last year, which I think is interesting. They're a little behind the times, as you know, compared to the average American beer brewery. But it's cool that we're starting to see like this real window into what's it like to live in the mountains of Japan and grow your own rice and make it into sake. Like, it's a fascinating kind of peek into that world.
Right. Yeah, in Japan, there's gaiatsu, that's the term, outside pressure. So people, Japanese people tend to recognize, oh wow, what we're doing is very important or valuable, because people outside Japan say, we are valuable. So that's kind of like the mindset. And the demand outside of Japan is really leading the growth, regrowth of Japanese sake brewery or revival of Japanese sake industry. So yeah, I think those social media energy is, I think it's becoming more important, and I feel hopeful about the stimulus.
Oh, I do. Yeah, I absolutely feel hopeful too. I also, kind of like what we saw in the sushi space, we are actually just now starting to see some reverse influence of the American sake brewing world on the Japanese world. It's a really new thing, but you're starting to see younger people build smaller breweries. You know, building a sake brewery in Japan, I couldn't tell you the last large sake brewery anyone built in Japan. It's been quite a while. But you're starting to see just a few younger people who are like, hey, you know, I don't want to build this giant monolithic thing that cost a fortune with all this. I'm just going to, you know, make 1,000-liter batches in a room with, you know, equipment that I kind of cobble together from around several industries, you know, beer brewing, winery, that kind of thing. And so we're starting to see that, you know, and just like in sushi, you can now get like a California roll in Tokyo. So some sushi trends actually reversed, influenced Japan. And we're just seeing that in the sake world. And it's pretty exciting.
Right. And then one of those exciting movement in the sake industry in Japan and globally, it's definitely American brewing is inspiring Japanese sake industry as well. So you are definitely one of the leaders. So
I don't know about leader sounds a little loaded, but I'm certainly doing the best I can.
Yeah. And so we're going to talk about the new brewery, Fujita Sake, in a moment. But first, let's talk about your first brewery called Dovetail Sake. So you opened Dovetail Sake in Massachusetts in February 2014 and had a great success. So tell us what your sake making philosophy was at Dovetail Sake, and what kind of sake did you make at Dovetail?
Oh, yeah, sure. So I did not own Dovetail Sake. I was the only employee, and I helped open it, and I brewed the sake, and did a lot of other jobs, but I did not own the company, so it wasn't, you know, mine to continue with. My brewing at Dovetail is very similar to my brewing today. So we were really committed to using sakamai, which is, you know, rice grown specifically for making sake. So we were lucky on timing. We had settled on another rice, and we had a problem with our label and our labeling machine. So we paused brewing. The very next week, we got a phone call that the first batch of Yamada Nishiki was available from Isbell Farms in Arkansas. And so we jumped on the chance to be one of the first breweries to use American-grown Yamada Nishiki. So we were committed to using, you know, the best ingredients we could get. And that's, you know, really worked out for us. So all three of the sake we ended up making in the, you know, interim years were Yamada Nishiki 60% mill rate, so Ginjo style sake. No, it was a great success.
Right. So basically, before you got Yamada Nishiki and Isabel Farms, that's kind of cheerleader of American sake making, because that's one of the very few farms that can produce sake rice for sakamai rice for making sake. So
right.
yeah, the Chris and Mark Isabel came here to talk about their production before. And it's just fascinating. They're having fun supporting, the sake industry. They have nothing to do with Japanese culture. Or originally, they happened to work with Japanese industry, but it's amazing. They're so passionate about creating new kinds of rice and of opportunities to support American sake production. So anyway, the other breweries can use non-sakamai, which is a kalos and table rice that you can eat, mm-hmm. but there's a special quality to use sakamai, right? So how do you describe the difference between sake made with sakamai and other table rice?
Yeah, so the large difference with sakamai versus table rice is in table rice, all your macronutrients, so protein and fat and carbohydrates, are mixed together evenly throughout the grain of rice. And so when you eat it, you get all of its food value, and it's easy to keep a high food value, which I'm sure was important for people long ago. So sake brewing rice, there's about 140 different cultivars of sake brewing rice in Japan. Over centuries, Japanese farmers isolated strains of rice where all of the starch is concentrated at the center. And so what that allows you to do is mill away around the starch and get rid of proteins and fats, which don't ferment into anything, using the yeast that you need to use to make sake. So as you mill the rice further and further down, you're getting rid of proteins and fats and sort of cleaning up the sake. And a higher percentage of your rice is now starch, which you can convert into sugar and ferment into alcohol. So in the Japanese system, the lower down you mill the rice, the higher quality the sake is. And so junmai sake can be anything. And below 60% is ginjo sake. And below 50% is daiginjo.
Mm. Right. So if you use sakamai, it's efficient to create purified flavor that you would look for in sake. And also, I mean, like, you know, milling rate is a contentious thing because the junmai, which could be around 70% of rice remaining.
Junmai used to be 70%, but they got rid of that in Japan.
Yeah, they keep changing the name. I mean, ginjo and daiginjo. And junmai just means pure rice, no added alcohol. Mm-hmm. But honjozo, that's another category. And we don't need to get into the details, but I think the milling rate means the remaining grain. People tend to think it's more refined if you have a smaller portion of grain left over because you only get the purified center. But do you agree? I like 70% remaining can be very, very sake flavored. And then like 23%, that could be very elegant sake, but it doesn't necessarily mean that it's a higher quality sake. So that's a great categories of ginjo, daiginjo, and honjozo. I'm not sure. What's your opinion about that?
Yeah, so I feel kind of like you. Obviously, as a brewer, I tend to see the whole problem as a scientific one. So, in Japan, when they say the grade of sake, to me, as you mill the rice further and further down, the sake becomes, more ethereal. You have less kind of round flavors to work with. It's like a really razor tight expression of rice. So if that means higher quality to you, then it does. However, the definition of that is wrapped up in the fact that I believe it originated with like tax payments in Japan. And as you mill the rice down, it gets very expensive. And so to give you an example, we currently use Yamada Nishiki 70% because I also like those more rounded flavors, more sort of complexity. However, the difference between the Yamada Nishiki at 70% that I use and 45%, which would be if I wanted to make a Daiginjo, the rice cost to me is double. So in Japan, they kind of had to sell it as a higher grade sake because they have to charge double, triple, quadruple the price of a regular sake. So you have to get the consumer to see that as a benefit for paying a higher price. And it seems like the Japanese brewers have been very successful in doing
that. Right, right. So the point is for listeners, if you go to a Japanese restaurant or any restaurant and find the grades of sake, junmai, daiginjo, ginjo, honjozo, and the milling rate doesn't necessarily mean the taste is better or not. It's about your preference. Right. But then price tend to be higher if it's more milled down because the original one is lost. So that's the thing. But it's all about what you like and your taste and some different labels, different breweries as different styles. And you just have to keep trying different things regardless of the milling rate.
Yeah, for me, if I'm talking to a beginner sake drinker, I just tell them to look for the word junma. Like, if they just take away one fact, I just say to the consumer, just go, listen, don't worry about anything else. Don't worry about where it comes from. There's two easy things for a beginning sake drinker. Look for the word junma, which just means that no added alcohol was added during fermentation. And so it's just pure expression of rice fermentation. The other thing is, luckily, in America, sake is very fairly priced. So if you buy a $15 bottle of sake or you buy a $30 bottle of sake, the $30 one will always be better than the $15. Which is a complaint I've heard from many, many people in the wine industry. I don't really drink wine myself, but there seems to be a lot of disparity in pricing and quality of wine. And that trips up a lot of consumers, I think, early on.
Right. Yeah, that's a whole other world to discover everything. Right. But, if it's not junmai, meaning if it's not junmai, some alcohol is added. But sometimes it's to round out the taste and the style. So, it's about your preference, right? What kind of style you like. So, the key is keep drinking, tasting different styles, and you
find that's right. So one interesting thing to note about honjozo sake is that American brewers cannot make it. So the way sake is handled in the United States, we are considered brewers because we're fermenting grain into alcohol. And you cannot add a distilled beverage to a brewed beverage in the United States. So we have to make junmai sake.
Interesting. Right. Okay. Well, but actually, it's a good thing too, because you can really express the pure rice flavor and grown, I would say, almost 100% grown in America, right? There are a few exceptions. Right.
Yeah, there's two places that grow Yamada Nishiki. There's Arkansas, Isbell Farms, and then there are some farms in California. And one of the things for me, I'm on the East Coast, ordering 6,000 kilograms of rice from California is kind of expensive to ship. So Isbell Farms is much closer to me. However, I also just love dealing with them. They're really great people. They know a lot about rice. They really care about the success of all of our little tiny breweries. I would order from them anyways. California, just for us on the East Coast, is so far to ship that much rice.
Right. That makes sense. Okay, so we'll take a quick break here. And when we come back, we'll dive into Tot's new brewery, Padestal Sake. So please stay with us.
Today's program is brought to you by Korin, a supplier of Japanese chef knives and restaurant supplies. Korin is proud of their Japanese culture and traditions, but they want you to know that their products are not just for Japanese restaurants. Their knives and tableware bring out the best qualities of food from every culture and fit into every restaurant from French to Pan-Asian to American. And that is why they're located in New York City, where people from every country in the world come to eat. Korin's Tribeca showroom is home to the most extensive collection of Japanese chef knives in the world, including Japan. Stop by to view their exquisitely designed tableware and the rarest natural sharpening stones. They have a whole range of knife services, from repair and rust removal to reshaping and realigning. Korin is dedicated to this ideal, bringing the highest quality Japanese design to your table so you can experience the unparalleled quality of Japanese craftsmanship in your home or restaurant. For more information, visit korin.com.
Welcome back. You're listening to Japan Eats on HRN, Heritage Radio Network. I'm your host, Aki Katayama, and my guest today is Todd Bellamy, who is the owner and brewer at Father's Star Sake in Massachusetts. But Todd joined us in episode 36 to discuss his previous successful brewery, Dovetail Sake, in 2016. So now, 2016 sounds like far away, like 7 years ago. So, and you opened your new brewery, Father's Star Sake, in 2021. So why did you open the new sake brewery?
So after my previous brewery closed down, I took a few years to work as a consultant in the brewing industry, both in beer and sake. And I really thought about what my next brewing venture would be. I always knew it would be a sake brewery. I just wasn't sure what it would look like and if we could afford to do it. So I took a couple of years to write a business plan while I was consulting. And we eventually got to a point where we could start construction in 2021 and then start serving sake in 2022.
Mm. So why did you name your new brewery Father's Star Sake?
So I really wanted the brewery to just be an expression of me. Certainly the sake would speak for that. But I also wanted to have fun this time around. I mean, Dovetail was a really great brand, but was rooted in like a very traditional New England aesthetic. And I wanted to put sort of no framework on what the brand could be. I could, you know, name it after something or, you know, whatever, any subject. And I just, as I kept thinking for months and months and months, I just kept coming back around to my love of science fiction and thought it would be a fun sort of brand to make for people.
Right. Yeah. Your website shows the label. It's a very, very futuristic, dream about the universe. So.
Yeah, I do. I've always been a space science junkie. I love space exploration and all kinds of different science. And so, I've always been that way since I was a little kid.
Mm, right. So one day some aliens get to drink your sake. That'd be amazing.
It would be amazing. I would also like to be the first sake on the International Space Station. Or in the new Artemis station to go around the moon. If they need sake for space, they should just come to me.
Mm, right. So NASA people, did you hear that? Who knows? What's the mission at Father's Star Sake, and how different is it from Dovetail?
Yeah, so the mission is really to be very, very accessible to everybody, much like a small local beer brewery would be. And so we have a full tap room where people can come and drink our sake there and talk to us directly. And we do events there and private events and food pop-ups. And so that increases our accessibility. And then the other aspect of accessibility for us is we wanted to use Yamada Nishiki rice, but I want to also price our sake at a very accessible point in the market in Massachusetts. So we use Yamada Nishiki 70 instead of 60 because it lowers the cost of the rice a little bit, which allows us to really make our sake accessible to everybody.
So the so 70 means 70% remaining out of the whole grain instead of 60%, 10% less quantity, so it's 10% more expensive, right? That's what,
right.
What you mean?
Right. Right. Yeah, right. So 70%, you know, 70% in my mind is sort of the bottom of premium sake in Japan. You can get some very nice 70% milled rice sakes. And, you know, we make, I think, great sake. And so... it's a really, you know, it's a great rice to use, and you don't have to mill it all the way down to, you know, really have a lot of expression and sort of breadth of flavor.
Mm. Right. By the way, out of many sakamai, Yamada Nishiki is so-called king of sakamai, so I understand why you want to keep using that specific, type of sake.
It's also easier on us, by the way. So even though the rice is more expensive, we spend sort of less energy or time on the labor side because it's very easy to steam and very forgiving. It grows great koji. And so we actually end up spending less time washing it and less time steaming it and cooling it, everything. So it saves us in other ways.
Mm. Okay, so rice does work for you instead of you have to work for
rice. Absolutely. Yeah.
Okay, so you have currently two flagship sake labels. That's, I like the name FSS-001 and FSS-002. So could you tell us about each?
Absolutely, yeah. So we have two styles in the market. I thought, you know, I'm building a local sake market in New England, and I'm the only sake brewery in New England. So I really have to start at the beginning for everybody. So we have one style called In a Strange Land. It is our flagship filtered sake. And then we have another style called Mountains on the Moon, and it is our flagship Nigori sake, or unfiltered sake. So In a Strange Land is obviously Yamada Nishiki 70. It's got hard water and two yeast strains. So it's really complex, a little bit fruity, a little bit spicy, and just has like a nice, clean, dry finish. Mountains on the Moon is on the flip side, is very soft water. And so it's a sweet Nigori, but it has a slightly higher acid so that it helps balance out the sweetness and makes it, you know, kind of drinkable.
Mm-hmm. Right. So it sounds like you adjust your order, the mineral contents, depending, so add back some minerals or filter and do play
with the water. Absolutely. Yep. So all of our brewing water is reverse osmosis and charcoal filtered. So we use just the water, you know, the local water at our brewery in Medfield, Massachusetts. We filter everything. And then per style in the tank, we modify the water chemistry. So In a Strange Land, our filtered sake is really complex and has some nice peppery notes and is a little dry. So the minerality kind of helps round it out, even though it's a little drier. And then Mountains on the Moon, our Nigori sake, has very soft water so that we get a little brighter and higher acidity to balance out all the sweetness of the unfiltered sake.
Mm-hmm. Right, so I got to taste both, and then in the Strange Land, that's the FSS-001. I was impressed by how clean the whole thing is, and then cleanness really showcased the flavor of rice that I was looking for in sake. Mm. And I don't know, the texture was so silky, velvety, and I don't know how you did it. Is the minerality, or how did you do that?
Yeah, certainly some of the minerality plays into that. Yamada Nishiki is just such a great rice to work with. Some other lesser quality rices are not rices that are very good for brewing sake. You're always constantly fighting to get enough glucose, not only to ferment into alcohol, but some of the glucose actually helps round out the sake and make it kind of rich on the palate. And so you can sort of ferment sake longer or, if you want a drier sake. And so luckily with Yamada Nishiki, we don't really have to fight to get enough glucose to work with. There's plenty there to work with. So we can really dial in the sake however we want.
And on the other hand, to be honest, I'm not the biggest nigori drinker, but I was impressed that the genda was very delicate and kind of like an elegant style. It's not like a coarse, a rough, chunky, punchy, fun nigori. It's very elegant. And also,
Thank you.
That the nihonshu is the you know, like a kind of sugar sweetness level. It was minus 10, but it was very subtle. It's very, almost like it tasted lightly sweet, but then it just disappeared. So I was impressed. It's very elegant. Both of them were very elegant style of sake, despite the fun labels.
Yeah, thanks. Yeah, certainly we're very serious. We don't take ourselves seriously, but we're very serious about making sake. And so we do have a fun sci-fi inspired brand. You know, I'm 50 years old, unfortunately. So all the sci-fi that I love from my childhood is 70s and 80s. And so it's largely kind of informed by that. But we do take ourselves very seriously. So yeah, we really wanted a nigori sake to be much more food friendly and sort of easily drinkable. So I, like you, was never a huge fan of nigori sake. Some of them are kind of thick. But then for me, I think it's missing like a counterpoint. And that's why we brew ours with an elevated and brighter acidic profile. To help balance some of that out. And then the other thing was, I knew that I didn't want, there's a style of nigori sake called usu nigori, for those of you who don't speak Japanese. So usu is thin. It's like a lighter, almost like hazy sake instead of a heavily kind of goopy sake. So I knew I wanted to be more towards that side of things.
And that happened. You made it.
Thanks. Yeah, I appreciate it. Yeah, I do. There are only a few nigoris that I really love. But Japanese brewers, I think, are just looking at a really different flavor profile. And so most of them, to me, are very ricey. So I think they're looking to kind of highlight the rice. I'm just not constrained by some of their sort of traditions, or the market's really different. So we could really think about it as what's going to appeal to our drinkers, but also, what's going to appeal to us at the same time.
Right. So you often mentioned already the approachable style. And then I have to mention your flagship sake, two labels served in glass bottles in 207 milliliters. Which is about
Correct.
7 ounces. So why did you choose a single serve glass bottle for your sake?
So while I was writing my business plan, I was at home for a long time, and I think I was driving my wife nuts. So she suggested I get a part-time job to just get out of the house a couple days a week, because writing spreadsheets and trying to raise money and stuff is pretty stressful when you're just trapped in the house. So I got a job at a local liquor store in my town because I had never seen the retail side of sake, and I was already thinking about all the, Japanese cups and cans, all the single serve sake that you see is just a much more accessible package. And because most of the drinkers in at least my market in New England, they're trying sake for the first time. So, wanting to try sake and trying it for the first time, a $40 bottle is a bit of a hurdle for a lot of people. So all the Japanese cups and cans are, between $6 and $10. And so it's an accessible way. So luckily, when I worked at the liquor store during my business plan writing, they allowed me to change their sake selection. So I had this sort of theory in my head that single serve might be like a really accessible way to go about making a brewery. But they actually let me carry it out in real time. So I got rid of all their big bottled sake except for one bottle for cooking. And then I just I put about 10 to 12 cups and cans from Japan in the refrigerator, like the open refrigerator next to the white wine. And, you know, the sales of sake for the store went up, you know, dramatically because it was almost zero to begin with. So they were selling cases of one cups and cans per week. So, you know, it was really great that I got to kind of test that out in real time. But I was already thinking that that single serve would be the way to go to overcome that hurdle of I'm trying something new for the first time.
Right. And actually, in Japan, the so-called cup sake, or canned even, started to be popular because I think younger generations like that. Cute labels or Instagram, or it's just easy to drink. So I think it's going to be increasing more. And I think your strategy is really good. And I think the right amount, 7 ounces, that's really just right to enjoy.
Yeah, thanks. You know, obviously, when you make a decision like that, we're going to make our brewery single serve, you're very inspired by cupped and canned sake from Japan. You know, especially like Kikusui Funaguchi, one of my favorite sake of all time. Their cans are really great and impactful, and they're everywhere. So, you know, you get informed by a lot of things. However, that type of packaging doesn't really exist in the United States inexpensively. So, you know, your only option is either a can with a regular can top on it or some kind of small bottle, most of them clear, which I wanted to avoid you know, protect the sake from light. And so I was lucky enough to contact the nice folks at Owens, Illinois. They're one of the largest glass manufacturers out there, but they actually make a small 7 ounce, 207 milliliter bottle that is sealed with a twist off beer cram. And so it really worked well for our needs and allowed us to have a little fun with it. I mean, it has a beer cap on it, but we're selling extremely high quality fresh sake in it. So it's a little fun at the same time.
Right. Okay. And also, I'm just looking at this taproom offering, which is beyond your you know, flagship labels. So there you offer a flavored sake, which is afternoon on Lisa, sake on the shore, leaf with cucumber, with fresh wine, and 15% ABV, and Kiwi's Goran sake, and summer sake, black tea with vanilla and hibiscus and flower. That's also 15% alcohol. So you used to get, you know, totally making very authentic style of sake, but it sounds like you're experimenting more of this flavored version. So why is that?
It's actually something I initially put in my original business plan. You know, I really fell in love with craft beer in America in the 90s. And there used to be a lot more kind of small breweries or restaurants. And so one of the things that they used to do, used to be really common in the beer industry, is they would make what's called cask ale. So they would take a regular beer that they had and they would put it in a cask, which is a sort of a more primitive keg. And they would naturally carbonate the beer. You know, some people would throw other things in the cask like coffee or, you know, other hops like fresh hops and stuff. So it allowed them to kind of take their regular beers and tweak them. And one of the things I always really loved was they would just tap a single cask every, let's say, Thursday night or something. And then when it was gone, it was gone. And then you had to wait till next Thursday until they tapped another one. So I really like the ephemeral nature of that, and it's very experimental and allows the brewer to play around without a lot of risk, right? Because you're not making 1,000 liters of black tea sake. You're making 20 liters in a keg. So that's what we started doing from the first day we were open. And really, it was for two reasons. One, it's kind of a leg up or a helping hand for folks who are very new to sake and are just so, you know, we get people who are like, I don't even know what this is. I don't know what it's supposed to taste like. And so for us to have some expressions that are flavored, it allows them to go, oh, I like lime and cucumber. Let me just try that. And they try it. They go, oh, it's delicious. And then the longer they stay there, they start to try unflavored sake, and they love that too. So I do like that, you know, experimental nature of it. But I also think it's a, I don't know, kind of an education tool, and it gets certain people to really enjoy themselves to the point where they start trying traditional sake.
Right. I'm a more purist, but by looking at this your menu and this whole day, like today in New York, I can just definitely go and then get one of maybe both refreshing sake with cucumber and a fresh lime, or black tea with vanilla and hibiscus. So,
yeah, actually, so we do, you know, obviously there's a seasonality to it. I don't make pumpkin spice sake in June or whatever, you know, whatever. I do make a pumpkin spice sake, just put that out there. But yeah, so there's a seasonality to it. But, you know, also one of the cool things is we've built such a great fan base here in Massachusetts that our sake we actually brewed for the summer for the tap room is actually not a flavored sake at all. It's just a beautiful, like, ginjo yeast sake, and it's very lightly hazy and sparkling. And so we just put out like a really traditional sort of modern sparkling Japanese sake. And that's our sake for the summer. And so, you know, people are loving it. And so the flavors are kind of cool because you can match it to the season. But the biggest hit this summer has been High Mags, which is our sparkling sake.
Right. Well, sounds like it's consistent with the, you know, sake used to be, still now, but the local natural beverage you make out of what's available. So sounds like you are in line with tradition of Japanese sake production.
I think so, too. I think we're starting to see a little bit more flavored sake or experimental stuff out of Japan, Japanese brewers. So I'm hoping someday that maybe they look at what we're doing and go, hey, you know, I live in a town in Japan and we have a lot of apples. Let's make an apple sake or whatever.
Mm.
You know? Ah. You know, that yeah, Japanese people love the whole meibutsu kind of concept. And so that would be cool.
Right. Yeah, meibutsu, it's a regional specialty, like any cakes to beverage to anything. So yeah, it's a very local mindset, which I think it's a beauty.
Yeah.
But yes. Speaking of making sake in America, now there are more than like breweries in America, like even dozens of sake breweries, and there's even the Sake Breweries Association of North America that was founded in 2019. So, and also this very weekend, the American Craft Sake Festival happened in Charlottesville, Virginia, and you are there too. So, how do you predict the future of sake made in America and probably other countries outside of Japan?
So there's fewer than 50 sake breweries outside Japan altogether. And so the number's growing, but there are a lot of barriers. So, you know, I think the sake industry will slowly, very slowly grow, not as quickly as like the beer industry or something like that, but it'll slowly grow. And then as more people get exposed to local expressions of sake, there's, you know, the local aspect, like what you're talking about, I add, you know, largely New England ingredients. That's one thing. But the other thing is, you know, local sake is just fresher sake. I mean, there's no way around, you know, the sake has to come from Japan. And it's just not the same as when it left the brewery because, you know, it's a very long way. And so, you know, I think fresh sake, I'm not saying it's better or worse than Japanese sake, but I'm just saying it's a different expression. And as more people in the United States get a local brewery near them, that will start to evolve. Not only their taste for different kinds of sake, but also it'll start to expand the market sort of exponentially, I think.
Mm, right. Yeah, in June, there is another sake tasting in New York. And I mean, a bunch of different styles of sake, all by American producers. And I was amazed how quality has improved over the years, and also creativity, which is not like just playful or anything. It's just out of the respect to the traditional flavors, but then why not doing this and that to, you know, American people want to drink this, and why not, right? And then it's made with right. local water and rice and yeast and those things. I think, personally, I really think that there's a big future waiting of Japanese sake, which also goes back to Japanese sake brewers in Japan to be inspired, because it's a very hopeful movement, right? It was declining. Mm-hmm. I mean, in like 50 years, the 4,000 number of 4,000 brewers went down to a quarter, and now it's coming back because of, you know, outside movement, the popularity of Japanese food and associated increased popularity of Japanese sake. So I think you are part of the big forces of the search, research of sake culture. And I really admire what you do.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, I appreciate it. I mean, the Sake Brewing Association of North America is also doing a lot to further kind of what's going on. You know, as my business grows, it becomes a little more stable. I mean, we just celebrated our first year anniversary. So, you know, I would hope in the future I would have more and more time to spend on, you know, the association stuff to help other people. But yeah, I'd also like to see some cooperation with young brewers in Japan, just to encourage them and say, hey, you know, you don't have to open a, you know, very expensive brewery. You could, you know, really open a brewery as a small business and grow it from there. So that, I think that would be a very important development if that really catches on in Japan.
Right.
I mean, it certainly worked here. The beer industry roughly was about 40 breweries in the 60s. And now there's, you know, north of 10,000. I've lost count. But on average, two beer breweries open every day in the U.S. Yeah, I mean, that would be really cool if that kind of fire swept through Japan and really just kicked off younger brewers who, you know, might find it hard to work in a 500-year-old brewery. So, you know, to just go, hey, I'm going to go do my own thing. I'm an artist and I want to express myself and I can just go do it on a small scale. That would be really cool.
Right. And also Asahi Shuzo, the makeup of the Dasai label, which is really famous for being premium, and you can see Dasai anywhere, almost in good restaurants. They're coming to America, opening their brewery this fall. So, and also they became a member of the American, the Sake Brewers Association of North America. So I think there's a collaboration between Japan and other brewers, which I think is exciting. And yeah, I'll see what happens. So what are your plans and dreams?
Oh, my plans and dreams. I really, my first plan or dream, certainly my dream is, we're New England's only sake brewery. And so really, the first dream I have is I just want to be in every state in New England. So, we're currently talking with sort of distribution partners in other states and trying to figure out what that would look like. Certainly my first dream is to do that. You know, be in every state, New England, and really be like a local sake brewery for everybody.
And eventually the International Space Station.
That is my plan, yeah. Or maybe an official SpaceX office sake. I don't know. There's lots of things we could do. If somebody at SpaceX or NASA or JPL or JAXA wants to call me, I would certainly pick up the phone.
Right. So let's see. Keep me posted. So where can we find your updates online and on social media?
Sure. We have a wide range of ways to get in touch with us. So certainly our website would probably be the smartest place if you're only going to remember one. It's just farthest starsake.com. Don't worry, we also own farthestarsaki.com if you misspell the word sake. And so that's a great place. And there are links on there to go to our Twitter page, our Facebook page, our Instagram page. And we have a really amazing link in bio connected to all of it. So we update it with taproom events and all of our pop-up food events and where we're going to be around town, like in stores, doing tastings, all of that.
Awesome. And you just raised a great point. Listeners, we want to sound like you know sake. It's not sake. It's not right. Sake. Sake.
Right.
So, all right. So thank you so much for joining us today, Todd. And maybe you can come back and, you know, update us on whatever you're working on.
Oh, I can't wait. And next time I'll drive down with some sake and we can drink it on the air.
Yep, that sounds good. And also congratulations on all the achievements.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, it was like the hardest thing I've ever done. But my whole family is behind me. So my wife comes in and works the taproom sometimes, even though she has a very serious like actual job. And my daughter makes custom t-shirts for the merch stand in the taproom and stuff. So it's really a family business, which is a pretty cool thing to do.
Hey, well, that's why your products are so beautiful. I'm not just saying that because it's so elegant, and your quality is just very impressive. So,
thank you. I hope we can grow and maintain that same quality.
I'm sure it's going to happen. So,
thanks.
Hey, so listeners, if you have any questions or comments about the show or suggestions for show topics or guests, please contact us at japaneseats@heritageradionetwork.org or akikateyama.com. Japaneseats is a weekly program and is always available at heritageradionetwork.org as well as on iTunes, Stitcher, and Spotify as a podcast. Engineer is Liam Warner, and thanks for listening. I will see you next week.
Japaneseats is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. Keep in touch at heritageradionetwork.org/subscribe.
Hi, listeners. We want to tell you about a podcast we're really digging. It's called Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio. Every week, they travel the world to find the most fascinating stories about food, including children who harvest cod tongues after school in Norway, and a detective who tracks down food thieves. And on Milk Street Radio, you can always find the unexpected. The comedian who ranks apples using an elaborate 100-point system, the secret history of grocery stores, and how to eat your way through Italy. They also interview the most beloved names in food like Jacques Pepin, Sola Awele, Jose Andres, Jet Tila, Ina Garten, Nigella Lawson, and Padma Lakshmi. Plus, co-hosts Christopher Kimball and Sarah Moulton do live calls with listeners and answer their questions about ingredients, techniques, and culinary mysteries. Like, why roasting a leg of lamb made one caller's oven explode? Ever wonder why your bread won't rise or your souffle falls flat? Chris and Sarah have the answers. You'll also hear from a rotating cast of contributors, including Kenji Lopez-Alt, Cheryl Day, Dan Pashman from The Sporkful, and Alex Inouz, a French guy cooking from YouTube. Take a listen at 177milkstreet.com/radio or just search your podcast app for Milk Street Radio.